you don't want to wait till the hard thing to like try to build that trust connection. You want to have those things in place so that when that hard time comes, you're ready for it. It just, to me, building trust, building connection, building that camaraderie in the relationships is so critical to them when something hard happens, to the unexpected, to facing uncertainty, to facing incredible challenges. We've already built that trust and connection.
Welcome to Partnership Plus, your go-to source for modern partnership wisdom with your host, Phil Hayes St. Clair.
Hey, it's Phil, and in this episode of Partnership Plus, we have the immense privilege to meet Kim Casey Campbell. Kim is a former US Air Force colonel who served over 24 years in the military. She flew over 1,800 hours and 100 combat missions in the A-10 aircraft in both Iraq and Afghanistan. She was an operational test pilot, awarded the Distinguished Flying Cross, and held the role of director for the Center of Character and Leadership Development at the United States Air Force Academy. Kim is a mum and a wife, a Marshall Scholar. She holds an MBA from the University of London and is the best-selling author of Flying in the Face of Fear, A Fighter Pilot's Lessons on Leading with Courage. It's an extraordinary collection of lessons, and we have a chance to dive into all of those today. You're going to love this episode. So without further ado, here is Kim Casey Campbell. Well, everyone, I could not be more excited to talk to this person, Kim Campbell, who has nothing short of an extraordinary backstory. We have been connected through a mutual friend, Ryan Hawke, who has spoken to Kim and worked with Kim on a range of different activities. And I would not like to give anything away except to say, Kim, welcome to Partnership Plus. It is such a pleasure to speak with you.
Awesome. Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Let's dive straight in about the Kim Campbell backstory, because from everything that I've read and seen about you in your fabulous book, which we're going to dive into, it is such a rich story, which I think a lot of people who have been to an air show, who have seen an extraordinary display of military air prowess, have just looked up at the sky and said, I want to do that. And often it happens at a very, very young age. So what is the Kim Campbell backstory?
Yeah, it does happen at a young age. And it was the same for me. It wasn't an air show for me, though. In 1986, I was 10 years old and watching the launch of the Space Shuttle Challenger, which was obviously there was this thrill and excitement of the launch. And then there was, unfortunately, the tragedy that played out in front of us. But for me, there was just something about that moment. There was something that even at the young age of 10, I recognized that the astronauts died doing something that they believed in, something that was bigger and more important than themselves. And there was something, for whatever reason, that just really resonated with me. And I kind of looked over at my mom. We were watching it together. And I was like, I want to be an astronaut. And I think my poor mom, she was just kind of like, okay, you know, not really sure what to think. That clearly was not my path prior to that. And so I talked to my parents about it. And my dad had said, you know, a lot of those astronauts are pilots, and many of them went to the Air Force Academy. It's something you might consider. And I don't think my dad also considered the fact that I would actually go through with this. My dad had gone to the Air Force Academy at a time when there were no women. And I think the idea of his little girl actually going off to do that was a whole different scenario. So for me, though, that was a pivot point in my life. I mean, that was the point for me. Everything changed. I mean, I started paying attention in school and just really committed to this idea of going to the Air Force Academy, becoming a fighter pilot, and then maybe someday, going off to become an astronaut. But that's where it all began for me.
It's such an amazing story. I remember reading in your book that there was that switch that flicked for you. And all of a sudden, like you say, school became a lot more important. The ability to go and train and become athletically fit and mentally tough started to take a very different priority in your life. When we fast forward through all of the steps, and I suppose what people maybe don't realize is that in order to get to a point where you are flying solo in a fighter aircraft, there is a lot that needs to happen from the point at which you even get admitted to the Air Force Academy, which I know there was a huge amount of tenacity for you writing letters when you were first not, you didn't receive the letter you wanted from the Academy.
Yes, I was rejected. We'll just put it that way.
Oh, rejected, okay.
Yes, I got a letter of rejection from the Air Force Academy, which, you know, was devastating to hear the word no, you know, like you're not good enough, but you're right. I didn't quit there, thankfully.
There was a lot of tenacity. Then it came to a point where you receive the admission letter. I'm sure that day will never be forgotten. And then starts the journey. So can we go from the point at which you started in the Academy, and just for people who aren't familiar with this process in the military of not just the selection to go to fly a particular type of aircraft, but to go to basic training, the stress that goes through all of that. And I think when we look at all the famous films, a lot of the YouTube footage, it looks as though you appear at the Air Force Academy and all of a sudden you're flying this amazing A-10 aircraft. And obviously it does not happen that way. So for people who aren't familiar with just that high level process, how does that play out and what was that like for you?
Yeah, I wish it was that easy. I mean, I have to say, getting rejected from the Air Force Academy initially and then getting a late offer for an appointment, there was something about that rejection that also was a little bit of motivation for me, we'll say. Like, I think for me, I felt like I needed to prove that I belonged there and I didn't want to just survive. I wanted to really thrive and excel. And so I knew that I had to work very hard at the Air Force Academy to get the pilot slot that I wanted. You know, it's a competitive process and it is all based on how well you do. And despite the rejection, I ended up graduating at the top of my class in the Air Force Academy, which then allowed me to get that pilot slot and then go on to pilot training. I would even say that pilot training was a little bit of a struggle for me initially. I had problems with air sickness. So for this little girl that all I ever wanted was to be this fighter pilot, I, again, kind of faced this like little bit of the wall of like, great, here's this thing I want to do. And I'm pretty miserable right now, feeling sick in the airplane. And obviously it impacted my initial flying. But I just looked at it like, okay, well, it's another hurdle I got to get over. And I eventually did. But again, to be at the top of your class, to choose the airplane that you want, you have to perform well. So thankfully I had the little slip ups early with the air sickness, but went on to do very well at pilot training, enough to the point where I could select the airplane that I wanted. And for me, that was the A-10. And the reason that I wanted to fly the A-10 was all about its mission. There was just something to me about a mission of supporting our ground troops. Helping ground troops get home safely to their families was just something that I felt passionate about. And I chose the A-10 and thankfully went on to fly almost 20 years in that airplane. So incredible airplane, but you know, you see it on the bio. What you don't see is all the hurdles that it took to actually get there.
That's it. And we're linking to a whole range of things in the show notes so people can get a familiarity with not just what that aircraft is, but a lot of the backstory. I suppose the thing that is really fascinating is that at that time when you were coming out of the academy and you were starting to really develop your early pilot career, there was a lot of combat that was about to come, you know, all of the world's way from the point of September 11 onwards. And, you know, you've deployed multiple times in different parts of the world. But let's dive into this day that was really quite something. And for anyone who's looking for this book, the book that Kim has written is called Flying in the Face of Fear. April 7, 2003. It is a story told with such detail, such vivid detail, that as you read it and as you listen to it, it's very difficult to understand the gravity if you've maybe not flown before. But we're talking about flying in a very complicated environment, one which there were seconds to spare. And the way that you've told the story, it does make it feel like time stood still for you in what was a hugely profound day, which from what it looks like started off as somewhat of a regular day. So can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, it was a day like every other day on a deployment, right, with a war going on. But, you know, it was so April 7th, 2003. At this point, our ground troops had pretty well pushed all the way towards Baghdad. And for us in the A-10 community, that meant we had moved forward to Baghdad as well, just in terms of where we were flying. Our normal mission set is we would take off from Kuwait. We'd fly all the way up to Baghdad. It's an hour in an A-10. We would air refuel, so fill up on gas, fuel, and then we would just wait. We would just wait for a tasking. Whatever was happening on the ground, we had a sense, but we didn't really know what we were going to be called to do. Unfortunately, on April 7th, there were clouds covering Baghdad, which was abnormal. Just as far as we could see, clouds covering all of Baghdad, and we weren't really sure we were going to be effective. And then we got a call, you know, crackle over the radio, and we get this call. And I very clearly remember hearing kind of the ground controller. I could hear like the stress in his voice. And he said, Yard 05, this is Advance 33. We're taking fire. We need immediate assistance. And, you know, hair in the back of my neck stands up. Adrenaline starts pumping because we know that lives are on the line. So we listen closely to, you know, his whole description of what's happening on the ground. And at the same time, we're proceeding directly to the target location, just hoping that we can find a hole in the clouds so we can get down below the weather. And I remember just kind of looking over at my flight lead at some point, and he had this like super confident, you know, very well and experienced in the airplane. I just watched him kind of roll inverted and then disappear down through the clouds to get below the weather. And then I just remember this like little bit of hesitation of like, this is it, right? Here we go. And because I don't want to screw it up, right? I mean, I looked down and found my own hole in the clouds. And as soon as I popped out down below the weather, I could see this massive firefight happening. There were bright flashes and smoke and tracers, and very surreal in many ways because it is everything that we plan for and train for, but to see it and to see this firefight was something very different for me. We knew we had to get in quickly, so we made a couple passes, rockets and gun, trying to get to a target that for us was underneath a bridge over northern Baghdad. And then I just, you know, we had decided that we would just do a couple passes because not only is there a firefight happening back and forth across the river, but we start to see like puffs of gray and white smoke and bright flashes in the air. So now the enemy is shooting us at us too. And I set up for my last rocket pass. I do all my standard checks. I roll in. Everything's going normal. I pull off away from the ground, away from the threat, as we normally do, trying to climb up just to get altitude and airspeed back. And then I just hear this huge explosion at the back of the airplane. And I know immediately that I am hit. I mean, there's this bright red-orange fireball. The jet noses over and kind of, well, it does, completely points down at Baghdad below me. And I just kind of instinctively just, I pull back on the control stick and nothing happens. Like the jet does not respond. And I remember just looking down at Baghdad, ground is getting closer. And I'm thinking, I'm going to have to eject. Like this is not, this is not what I had planned. And then training kicks in and I just quickly try to analyze the situation, figure out what's going on. I've got lights flashing at me. This whole caution panel on my side is lit up. And I remember looking and seeing these hydraulic lights and my hydraulic gauges were at zero, which hydraulics is how we can control the airplane.
Yeah, systems empty.
Hence the reason that I'm plunging to the ground out of control.
Yeah. It's extraordinary. And what was your altitude at the point where that started to happen? Because when we think about aircraft, particularly fighter aircraft, you know, the A-10 is quite specific to be able to get in quite low. It's very atypical. So where were you at about that point?
Yeah, I mean, we can operate at about 100 feet off the ground, you know, the 100 to 500 feet, depending upon how experienced we are. But normally we're up at like 20,000 feet-ish, you know. And I was at about 7,000 feet or so when this happened. So we had gone down low to shoot, now climbing back up, trying to get our energy back while also staying below the clouds, which unfortunately means that we're highlighted. I mean, if you're looking from the ground up at an airplane that is, you know, backlit from the clouds, very easy to see. But for us, that was the risk we were willing to take because these troops on the ground needed our help. But not a situation I ever thought that I would find myself in.
Extraordinary. And The A10, for anyone who doesn't know, is built with extraordinary redundancy. So the systems, whilst all hydraulic fluid is gone, the system is not responding as possible. Something then happens to get you home. Do you want to tell us a little bit about how this aircraft is built to deal with such redundancy? And by the way, this was designed, I think, back in the 50s. Is that right? The airframe was sort of designed as...
The first airplanes came out in like 1978, 79, 80, right, are all the ones that we were flying. But I mean, you're right. It was built to take hits. I mean, it was designed specifically to support troops on the ground, knowing that we would potentially take hits while performing its mission. So even though I'm plunging to the ground, there's no hydraulics, I'm thinking about ejecting, I also know that I have this emergency backup system. It is a system that allows us to fly on cranks and cables, no hydraulics, but it's called manual reversion. And thankfully, it's just a switch that we flip. It's not something that we pre-flight plan. It's not something that we train in very often, but I flipped the switch. And thankfully, that airplane started to climb up and away from Baghdad. And it's what allowed me to get home safely. I mean, without that emergency backup system, I likely would have been flying a parachute down into central Baghdad, which I don't think would have gone very well.
No, not a great end of the day.
No, not at all.
There, you say, or you talk about this idea, there was about an hour or an hour plus flight home in order to get away from or out of enemy airspace back to friendly territory. And just getting home, the job wasn't quite done yet. You know, Landing a plane in this mode is not something, as you said in the book, it's not something that is often trained for. And I'm sure there was teams far and wide, you know, really rooting for you to get home safely and to land this aircraft. What was that like on that last moment? I remember you talking about this idea of, you know, if you get to a point where you can't eject, it's there is this point of no return, essentially, to try and land that aircraft.
Yeah, it was that trip home was probably like the longest hour of my life, just trying to make a decision and feel good about the decision. And, you know, I knew that I could get back to friendly territory and eject if I needed to. I knew the rescue helicopters would be there for me. But ejecting wasn't something that I took lightly, you know, and I felt after an hour, I felt very comfortable flying this airplane. It was something that I hadn't trained to do, to land in manual reversion, but I at least knew of the stories of the pilots that had come before me. We had learned from their experiences some things to do differently. So I had all of that, you know, going on in my mind of all these things. But like you said, there was this awesome team, some that I knew about, some that I didn't know about, providing mutual support. I had these airplanes overhead providing cover for the hour-long flight home. The rescue helicopters, you know, our emergency response crews, like there's this whole team that's got my back. So yes, I'm in this airplane single seat flying by myself, but I have this entire team, including my wingman, right? Who is the most important person, providing that mutual support. And, you know, he had my back the whole way. We bounced ideas off each other. He reassured me, you know, just knowing that this was a pretty terrifying situation. But to have somebody like that, to provide that mutual support, to be by my side, to have my back, to believe in me, was huge for my confidence, for my belief in myself. And it was, you know, to me, when I look back on this mission, that's what stands out to me most. I mean, yes, I flew this airplane by myself, but I had a whole lot of people that were by my side providing that mutual support, helping me to ensure that I could get back safely. And even if things did not go well, they were there waiting. You know, no matter what, I would have this team, whether it was rescue helicopters, the emergency response crews, I had this whole team, you know, supporting me, which made a huge difference.
It's quite extraordinary. So the wheels hit the ground, you come to a rolling stop. I can only imagine the relief must have been extraordinary.
Yeah.
There is congratulations over the radio from people who have been onlooking on all of this. And in the context of being deployed, it's a very important day. And you now know that tomorrow is another day where everyone is still going to be doing their job. They're still going to be flying the sorties they've got to fly. in a deployment, there's often not a lot of time to reflect and think about everything that's gone on. And in such a massive day in your life, how did you have a chance to reflect on that? Or did it have to be sort of compartmentalized and you sort of wait for that to happen after you get home or maybe in the years to come? How was the time to sort of process all of that through? Because it's quite an extraordinary event.
Yeah. It was a little bit of both, I think. After landing the airplane, there was just this like huge adrenaline high. I felt like, you know, just it took me some time to come down from that. I didn't really talk about it much after I landed. I mean, certainly people asked me some questions, but I didn't really take the time to really think through or talk about it too much. I mean, we debriefed the mission itself, but kind of the personal concern and doubts of the fact that I came very close to dying, I didn't really come to grips with that. And I'll be honest, I compartmentalized most of it. Like I just tucked that away of like, I felt like I couldn't open it up right then because there was still a war going on. I still needed to be able to fly missions. But I did, the one thing I did that I think that was helpful was that night I journaled everything out. I just kind of wrote through the whole mission and kind of what I was thinking. And that allowed me enough space to decompress. And then the rest of it, I just kind of tucked away to deal with later once I got home from the deployment and had an opportunity to kind of talk with my husband, who is also an A-10 pilot. So,
yes,
you know, share all those things, right? Having a partner in life that, you know, he was essentially, right, my wingman, right? Somebody that he understood what I was going through. I could talk through it with him. And that was really helpful for us. And honestly, very helpful for our marriage as well, because this happened pretty early when we had been married. And it allowed us to have some very tough conversations about our priorities in life very early in our marriage. So I don't know. For me, I look back on this mission and yes, was it terrifying? Yes. There were a lot of negatives and things that, you know, life-changing really, but I learned so many lessons from it that, you know, that ability to compartmentalize and move on, but also prioritize what's important to you in life. I guess in many ways I'm grateful for it.
It's extraordinary, Kim. I mean, and this, for this to happen so early in your career, it feels to me as an observer from the outside, it feels like you've paid that forward consistently all the way through your career to make sure that everything that was learned, everything that was absorbed, could be paid forward to all of the teams. And you spoke with great affection of Lieutenant Colonel Rick Turner, who was your lead in the air, side by side all the way through this experience. The Air Force, like the Army, where I'm from in Australia, you know, we spend a lot of time getting to know each other through very arduous training. We spend a lot of time, experiencing things which allow us to develop a language and a culture that reinforces that really strong work ethic and the humor that comes with that and all the things that are really important to make, you know, sometimes not so fun circumstances, ones that you can endure and actually frankly enjoy. When you think about that experience of that day and everything that happened subsequent, how did that reinforce your understanding of the importance of partnerships in such a high stakes environment, knowing that from your husband's point of view, in probably a one in a million circumstance where technically he would understand a lot of what you can say, in many cases, you know, an at-home partner still has a distant understanding of what people do professionally. So that was a super unique circumstance. When it comes to that partnership mentality, knowing, and for those who don't understand, the crews that look after your aircraft, the crews that look after the airspace, you will sometimes know them quite intimately. In other cases, they're just, you know, a voice on the radio. How has your perspective on partnerships sort of evolved, I guess, from that day all the way through your very incredible military career?
Yeah, there's a couple things, right? I think one, you touched on it, is when you do hard things together and you go through hard things together, it really strengthens those partnerships, right? I look back on that first deployment and the people that I deployed with, and we are still connected today, right? It builds these incredible bonds. The key thing, I think, though, is that we're constantly working on building relationships, building trust, building connections, building that partnership, having trust in each other, so that when it comes to the hard thing, when it comes to the really terrifying experience, when it's to the point where you are going to be called on to perform at your highest level, those partnerships, the trust, the connection is already in place. And I think that's the key thing. You don't want to wait till the hard thing to like try to build that trust connection. You want to have those things in place so that when that hard time comes, you're ready for it. It just, to me, building trust, building connection, building that camaraderie in the relationships is so critical to them when something hard happens, to the unexpected, to facing uncertainty, to facing incredible challenges. We've already built that trust and connection.
It's interesting how far it perseveres too. Like you say that, you know, so many people that you've known from that time, you know, are still very much in your circles. We have a similar circumstance here. There are some people who I've met who have become very close friends who was essentially once removed from my friendship group at the time I was serving. And now we may as well have been brothers, you know, born of the same year, even though some are much older and some are much younger. It's quite extraordinary how that all plays out.
Absolutely.
Can we turn attention to an aspect of your book, which talks about the element of the fighter pilot mindset that relates to reflecting back and having the debrief? And we've spoken on this show a number of times to fighter pilots that speak so vividly about the importance of that very repeated step after every single sortie. It doesn't matter if you're flying three a day, one a day, once a week. It's the same process that allows you to, you know, be vulnerable and understand what went well, what could be celebrated, what really needs to be improved in a very frank and rankless kind of circumstance, so that the learning is rich every single time. Many who I've spoken to long to see that play out more in the outside of the military and don't really seem to find that very much, which I think is a real shame and a missed opportunity. But can you tell us a little bit about that review process that goes on, which is very native to you and I think could be used to strengthen partnerships everywhere and relationships everywhere? What is that review process like, and what would you recommend people think about if they weren't experienced in that kind of review process in the private sector?
Yeah, and I think the first thing I would say is that to really have an effective debrief and after action review, there has to be an environment of trust, right? It's all built on that trust and connection, because that's where people feel safe to provide feedback, right? If we're going to admit that we make mistakes, if we're going to provide feedback to others, we have to feel like it's a safe place to do that.
Right.
That a lot of times comes from leadership, right? How well do we set the example with that? How well do we respond when presented with feedback? So I think leaders really need to set the example with that. A debrief for us, like you said, it happens after every mission. It's whether the mission was a success or the mission was a failure, right? We want to talk about the successes so that we repeat it again on the next mission, but then we're going to drill down into the mistakes that we made. We're going to identify the root cause of that mistake. So continuing to ask the question why. We're not going to take the easy way out and just blame somebody. We're going to really drill down into what was the root cause, then what lesson did we learn, and then what are we going to do differently on the next mission. Like I said, for that process to be successful, we have to check rank and ego at the door, right? Yeah. We need to be able to have our youngest, least experienced members in the flight, the wingmen in our case, to be able to provide feedback to the more experienced members in the flight. It's absolutely critical to have an open, safe space where people can provide feedback without blame, without shame. The other thing that I think is critical is that we then walk out of that debrief. We walk out as better pilots, as better leaders, as better teammates, and we share those lessons outside of just that small unit. You're right. We share the lessons with the rest of our team. If there is something that we learned that we that you know needs to be shared with others, which I think is most of the time, we want to open that up, not just in our own little small circle, but how do we open it up more broadly to the team, to the organization? And that's what helps elevate the performance of the entire team. But I think that debrief, right, it's certainly part of our mindset. It's part of our culture. But I think a debrief, an after action, a post-team huddle, whatever you want to call it, it really is critical to help creating an environment that's focused on continuous improvement, of learning to fail forward, right? Learning from mistakes and failures along the way. It helps us be flexible in an environment that's constantly changing. It ensures that we're not so rigid, you know, well, we've always done it that way. We're not going to change. Well, that's the idea of a debrief, is you present ideas of doing it differently, doing it better. But it does take courage. It takes courage to provide feedback, and it is built on a foundation of trust and respect. And so that to me is the key. You build the trust and connection, and then you can have a space where you can do the debrief.
It's interesting as well, because I think a lot of people don't realize the stress that comes with flying an aircraft, being part of the ground crew that is doing the prep, the receipt of the aircraft, getting it ready again. You know, on deployment, these are very long days, long weeks, long months. And yet still every single time you finish flying, everyone's to the room, everyone's having that conversation, no matter how fatigued and how tired you are, because that depth of desire to make sure that we can learn is just so strong. How long do these conversations generally last for? Can they be as long as they need to be? I mean, obviously it might be related to the duration of the flight that just happened, but on average, if somebody was to say to you, how long should a debrief be, knowing that this is more likely to be asked from a private sector, non-military point of view, what are we thinking to give people a sense of how long those conversations should take to make them valuable for the people involved?
The short answer is it depends, but I think on average, if I were just to say an average, I think, you can have a very effective debrief in an hour. I think, there is something to be said about attention span. And I know after a long flight, after a long negotiation, after a long presentation, whatever it may be, people are exhausted, people are wiped out. So how do you pull those lessons learned very quickly? And having a process to do that is really critical. I'm kind of the belief that if you do a 5 to 10 minute huddle, that is better than nothing, right? Mm-hmm. Even if you just do a quick, like, hey, this is all the time that we have right now. We're going to pull some quick lessons after we just walked out of that briefing, the negotiation, whatever it is that you just did, the project that you worked on that you just briefed to senior leaders, and you walk out and you do a quick 5-10 minute huddle, that's better than nothing. But to really, take some time and sit down and really think about it, that's going to take a little bit longer. I think probably the biggest thing that I see with organizations, a lot of people will try to do an after action, but they're not really learning lessons. They're just identifying them. So they'll annotate some things that went wrong, and maybe they'll say, oh yeah, next time we should do that. But then like the report gets stuck in a binder or some folder on somebody's laptop, and then we repeat the same mistakes over and over the next year at the next event, I think that's the thing, is how do we actually make these lessons learned? And it's making somebody the, point of contact. They are the person for this thing, and really just making sure that we can pull from those lessons and do it differently. Otherwise, we're just going to repeat the same mistakes again.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And, when we think about the breadth and depth of your organizations, the ones that you've led, we're in hundreds and thousands of people. Where there are multiple layers, everyone knows their job quite well, they've been trained very specifically for different roles. There will be some times, no doubt, where you're working with branches of the military that you don't have direct connections to, where there are very different capabilities quite specifically to get a job done. And you might not have a lot of time to be able to build the depth of trust that you might like, because they might come to bear on a problem which is a little bit what's happened quite suddenly. How do you think about bringing trust into a relationship where there actually isn't, years to build up? There's not those shared experiences, but there is an expectation from the other side, because they've stepped up to the mark where they would want to do a great job as well. How do you suggest people build trust quickly, or as we say, collapse the time to trust, so that at the very beginning, at least, you can get the job done and then, see what comes from it after that?
Yeah, I think, we see this a lot with whether we're working across services or across nationalities in different countries. And the more we work together, the better we are, right? The more we practice together, the more we exercise together, the more we figure out what's not working, the better we are. But how do you come to that environment? I'm a big believer in humble, approachable, credible. I think that works in so many different parts of our life. But one, we come with credibility. We take care of our our own responsibility of being good at what we do, but we're also humble and approachable. So we're willing to learn from others. We're willing to see that, you know what, they might do a little differently than us, but I'm willing to listen and learn from you. And I think that goes a long way to building relationships is, you know, sometimes, okay, maybe especially fighter pilots, we can walk in a room and think we have all the answers. Well, that is not really a great approach, it turns out. You know, why not take some time to listen and learn from others who are different than you, that have a different background, who have a different experience, and listen to see what they bring to the table. And I think that just, that goes a long way into building that relationships and building that trust, because everybody's, you know, I don't know, there's anytime you walk into a room and it's new people, new things, you don't really know each other. There's always a little bit of that, like worried about being judged by others, and also our own tendency to kind of come quick to judgment. But I think if we can walk into a room and be humble, like, hey, we don't have all the answers. We don't always do it right. Let's listen. Let's learn from each other. Let's work together. Let's find the best way to do this together. I think that just goes a long way. So obviously we need to put in the work and be good at what we do, be credible and capable, but I think humility and approachability are also key.
I agree. And one of my favorite times of heading overseas as a soldier was landing in Air Force bases and seeing the aircraft of other countries' military arrive at around the same time. You're all sort of going through their version of customs and you're looking at each other. We're all wearing different uniforms. We're all there to do the same job. You're hoping that we get a chance to have, you know, a beer or two at the end of the day and sort of chat. And it's funny how, you know, if you possess that curiosity, what you can learn, and then you end up on the same playing field together in different contexts, you end up with this fabulous learning environment where, and I'll never forget sort of doing this with the Filipino military, where we were able to learn some of their tradecraft, which is in such a vastly different environment. You know, the Philippines, as most people know, are a very vast collection of islands. You know, they specialize essentially in jungle warfare. In Australia, we tend to specialize, given our native country, in very dry, very wide open spaces. And it's very interesting to sort of have those conversations to learn more about how you can do things differently. I do miss those times. They're a lot of fun.
Some of my favorite times were at Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan, and just all the different countries that were there together, you know, same mission, but coming from different places, different backgrounds. And I got to do a lot of like sharing the A-10 and talking to other people about the A-10. And I actually have a ton of pictures from different soldiers from around the world in front of the A-10. It was just, I don't know, such a great experience. Like you said, like, deployments are not fun. Being away from your family is not fun, but we sure did make the most of it. You know, we really did. Sure. And I think building the connections with different people from around the world is something that I look back on. You know, I look back on what a blessing to be able to have that experience and something that quite honestly was a pretty terrible environment. I guess I try to look at the positive things.
Absolutely.
That's kind of my, I don't know, the way to get through some of those tough times.
I agree. And I do hope that our children, like you never wish for children to be involved in any kind of warfare. But I do hope there is the opportunity for them to be able to experience an environment which enables them that kind of learning and that kind of richness. Because I think it's a real shame when you feel as though there just isn't the exposure to that, to be able to sort of understand how you can grow as a human and live life that way. Let's change tact a little bit, Kim, into, you know, how you transitioned from the military into your leadership work and the way in which those lessons have been sort of carried across, of which I know there are countless numbers. Selfishly, when we talk about partnerships and the lessons from the military, what do you think, from a partnership perspective, the most applicable lessons that can be carried across from what you've seen in your leadership work in the military into the business world?
Yeah, I think, you know, I think there is something pretty special about kind of the camaraderie and the sense of purpose that we had in the fighter pilot community, specifically in the military. To me, I identify that as what I call the wingman culture. And I think there's something important about that, but I think it's also something that can apply outside of the military as well. because having a wingman by your side, creating a culture where you're focused on a common purpose, where there's something bigger and more important than yourself. If you go look at Simon Sinek, it's the start with why, right? It's our common purpose, our belief, our reason for being, why we do what we do. The other thing that I think is critical is in a fighter squadron, you know, we all know the role that we play, you know, from the youngest wingman to the most experienced instructor, we each understand the role that we play, where we fit into that bigger picture. We also understand that our individual performance is critical for shared success. Mm. I think that's critical for many organizations, right? If we understand our purpose, our why, and where we fit into the bigger picture, it gives us that bigger understanding, more buy-in and belief in what we're doing. So I think a wingman culture is critical. It's this idea that everyone on the team has a role to play. You know, for us, it's the, you know, everyone who designed, built, maintained the airplane to the pilots who flew it. Everyone has a role to play to achieve mission success. How do we take that into our businesses and organizations so that everybody understands where do they fit? How do they help this team, this organization achieve mission success? Because when we know the role that we play, we understand our responsibility in that role that we play. I think that helps us. One, it gives us like drive and motivation to understand where we fit into this bigger purpose. So I think a wingman culture is critical. I mean, it certainly is nice to have that mutual support of a wingman, right? Hmm. And I think a wingman is not there to just be a cheerleader, right? It's not just support and encouragement. I look at it as a wingman is also somebody that will challenge you as well. You know, I even take this so far as my partnership, my relationship with my husband, right? He's my wingman. He does support me, he encourages me, but he also will call me out and challenge me, which I, you know, I think that's so critical in any partnership, any relationship, you know, business or personal, professional, to have somebody on your team that will have your back, will push you a little bit to be at your best. And I think that's a lot of that wingman culture that comes out of that military fighter pilot community.
When you think about a partnership that you've seen, if we step away from that really profound event for you in 2003, beyond that point in the rest of your career, was there any partnerships that really jumped out at you as being the exemplar where you just saw the whole thing work really well and that switch in your brain went, so this is what it looks like to be really fantastic?
Yeah, I think for me, so later in my career, I had the opportunity to lead teams and, you know, I had the opportunity to lead a group, which was about 1,000 people. All of my airmen, civilian and military, were spread throughout South America, Central America, and the Caribbean. I mean, just very broad range of missions, very broad range of people, a lot of different backgrounds. I'm certainly not the expert. I mean, as a pilot, I have a lot of people working for me that do a lot of different things. And so I'm really relying on them for their expertise. But I had, we call it a command chief, a chief, a senior enlisted leader. Mm-hmm. So somebody on my team who really had the pulse of the team, who really was able to connect with the members of my team. He was a true, and when I look at partnership, you know, that partnership, that relationship for us, you know, to have somebody on your team that is willing to shut the door and give you honest feedback, mm-hmm. I think is critical. Whether that's in, you know, if I look outside the military, whether that's, you know, in your personal team or somebody outside, I think we all need somebody like that, that will hold you accountable. You know, it's your accountability partner. It's somebody that's going to give you feedback when you don't do something really as well as you could, to tell you when that message that you just shared didn't come across as in the way that, you know, that you really intended it to. So I think it's done in a kind and compassionate way, but I think it's also, you know, you need that honest feedback. So I certainly think that's one to me that I look back on and I realize how critical it is to build a team, to build relationships, to build partnerships with people that don't always look like you, sound like you, think the way that you do. Mm. You want to have people on your team you build these partnerships with that are going to challenge you a bit and give you feedback and, you know, push you outside your comfort zone sometimes too, which isn't always, you know, it's not always easy. It's certainly not comfortable. But I think that to me is critical.
It's interesting with that chief relationship. How often would you say, and I think I know the answer to this question, but how often would you say you would be speaking to that person on any given day or week?
all the time.
Right.
And part of that was we traveled together. So we, you know, there's always time for feedback and, you know, and it takes some time to build that trust and relationship. But I always knew when he came in, he's like, ma'am, you mind if I shut the door? And I'm like, oh, I know something's coming.
Something's coming. Yeah.
You know, you kind of get that. You build that relationship over time, but it's constant, you know, it's constant feedback, constant discussion. And the other side of this, right, is leadership can be lonely. It can be really lonely. Oh, yeah. So to have somebody that you can, you know, that you trust, that you can kind of bounce ideas off one when you're uncertain about something, but you know, every now and then you got to be able to vent too, and you got to find that person that you can vent to, and whether or not it's, you know, it's somebody on your team, maybe it's somebody outside, maybe it's a spouse, but somebody that you can kind of just relax with and be honest and open with. I think that's critical too.
Yeah, it's super important. And it's funny as well. The reason I asked about the tempo of conversation is that when we think about building relationships between companies where they could be, on face value, they look quite similar. There could be great signals being sent from both sides, but often it just takes a regular tempo of conversations to build that mutual understanding, you know, those cues, the ability to sort of make sure that if you're not in the room and a decision's being made, ultimately they can stand up for your best interests, and they would hope and expect that the same thing would happen for you as well. And I think when it comes down to it, I see many people who see a partnership fall apart, and we'll get to some cautionary tales in a second, but we see the partnerships fall apart, and the first diagnostic question is, well, how often are you getting FaceTime together? How often are you building that language? And it's often, well, we signed a deal and then 6 months later, nothing happened. And I said, well, how often did you catch up? Well, maybe twice. Like, well, that's not going to fly. So there is that element of just developing a shared language that I think is super important. And it's interesting because in the military, often the use of language is very technically specific. So we love acronyms and there are plenty of them and we all know usually what they mean. But when you get outside into, you know, the private sector and into government organizations, there is just different languages. So the ability, I think, to try and craft something that is well shared and well understood, you know, when you get to a point, you can look someone over the table who's been a partner of yours for some time, and just a look is enough to sort of communicate an intention. I think it becomes, you know, really, really important.
Yeah. Partnerships take work. You know, they really do. You can't just hope, you know, you sign and you have this agreement. You got to continue to put in the work. It's like a constant, you know, you may have a good relationship to start, but you got to continue to put in the work and have the FaceTime and make sure that you're continuously aligned as you continue to evolve, as your team continues to evolve, as your company continues to evolve and adapt. Is that relationship, is that partnership evolving and adapting in the same way that's mutually beneficial?
That's it. And so from a cautionary tale point of view, we've all been part of these partnerships that you kind of hoped and expected would turn a little bit differently. What's your cautionary tale that I guess keeps on reminding you of exactly that? You know, we've got to invest time to make these work. Have you got an example that sort of stays in the back of your mind?
Well, I think the most important thing is that partnership has to align with your mission, your vision, and your values. And I think once it does not, we also have to be willing to kind of have the courage and acknowledge that this partnership is no longer beneficial based on the fact that we no longer see eye to eye. You know, we have a different mission, vision, and values in the way we want to move forward. And I think sometimes sometimes we hang on too long to something that we've agreed to. And I think we have to be willing to acknowledge when it's time to dissolve the partnership as well. And I guess I see too many occasions and I've seen too many experiences where you're nervous to make that decision. You're worried about hurting feelings. And I think you can still do hard things in kind and compassionate ways. So I think it's critical to also know when to let go, you know, when the partnership is no longer beneficial really for either party.
I could not agree more. You know, earlier you mentioned the idea of having conversations that do require vulnerability. And one of the comments that you make in your book, and I've heard you talk about this before, is you know, vulnerability isn't weakness. It's about being open to uncertainty. What advice would you have to somebody who is feeling that, yes, vulnerability is important, but I'm quite worried about being vulnerable? Obviously, if there is not an environment of trust that's been established, that's really problematic to enable that vulnerability. But what would be your advice to somebody that maybe doesn't have that environment, but knows that there is power in that vulnerability?
Yeah, I mean, I guess coming from somebody that it's hard for me to be vulnerable, right? It is uncomfortable. It doesn't come naturally. I think it's more of like, I recognize the importance of it. I recognize that when we are vulnerable, especially in a leadership position, it allows other people on our team to be vulnerable. It allows those people that we want to create partnerships with to be vulnerable. And you're opening up, you're putting yourself out there to some uncertainty, some risk. But what's on the other side of that, right? I think when we are vulnerable, it opens our, we open ourselves up to connection, to greater trust, to, you know, it's just an opportunity to build something that wouldn't be there without the vulnerability. And a lot of times, especially as leaders, we have to take that first leap. We have to kind of, well, there isn't a whole lot of trust built here, but I'm going to take that leap of faith, and I'm going to be vulnerable. I'm going to open up, and I'm going to share within reason. But I'm going to open up, I'm going to share, I'm going to trust others, and I'm going to be vulnerable, because I know that that is what helps create connection. It's what helps build trust.
Such great advice. Now, you might or might not know this, but at the end of every one of these episodes, we jump into a rapid fire, and we're going to get to that in just a second. I'm very excited to hear what your answers are to these questions. Before we do get to that, you know, so much of your career and so much of, you know, the energy you bring to relationships is, you know, based on a partnership mentality. At least that's what I can see from the outside. And it's really something to be lauded. When you think about the state of the world right now, but whether it's happening at a state level, an international level, the way that organizations are talking to each other or not talking to each other, what do you think leaders are missing when it comes to wanting to grow through partnership? Because it's a very romantic term, right? You know, we use the term partnership for our husbands and wives, for our, you know, our life partners, but then we also use this idea that we must partner more to get an outcome. Yet there isn't really that drive to get to that true point of partnership where your hair is on fire and it's really just working so well. What do you think leaders are missing about that, or not seeing at the moment around that?
I think sometimes, and I can think back to times, I'm guilty of this too, right? Sometimes we feel like we can do it all ourselves. We can do it alone. You know, we're just fine. You know, sometimes it's the fear of trying something new, of putting ourselves out there, of, you know, it does open up maybe some risk and uncertainty. You know, I'm a big believer in when you feel the fear, the doubt, the worry, you do your research, you do your homework, but it is all about what you do in those moments. And I think sometimes we kind of protect ourselves in the, I can do this myself, we don't need a partnership to do this. But I think we're also missing it out on the greater gains. You know, what's on the other side of that when you have a partnership, when you have that built-in trust and connection, and you're pushing each other, you're encouraging each other, you have each other's back, you're building, you're growing together. It's this idea that, yeah, it can be a little scary. It can be a little bit uncertain. Yes, there's the risk involved. Yeah, absolutely. But what's on the other side of that? It's an opportunity to grow and elevate performance. And so it's just getting on the other side of that fear.
Amazing. All right. 5 questions. Are you ready?
Yes, I think so. I'll try to do rapid fire response as well.
All right, here we go. Question number 1. Complete this sentence. Partnership is?
Partnership is an opportunity to develop and grow while also helping others to develop and grow.
Question number 2. What content are you loving at the moment? And it can be anything.
I actually just finished listening to Atomic Habits by James Clear. And I've been familiar with his work for a long time, but it's brilliantly simple. And I have a teenager, he's 16, and I'm like, oh, if I could just get him to listen to this. So yes, Atomic Habits. I think there's something brilliantly simple about applying habits to your daily life. I'll stop there because I'll go on too long.
Yeah, I'm at risk of doing the same. I think it's almost a book that for anyone of a certain age, it gets gifted. It's almost as if it's a book that needs to be, you've turned 15, please read this book and don't come out of your room until you finish it cover to cover.
Absolutely.
I think it's also one of those ones that we could read multiple times in our lives and you would sort of take on the content in a very different way every time you read
it. Yes, very, very true.
All right, question number three. What is the worst piece of advice you've received and why?
I'll try to make this one short. I got advice, my husband and I got advice very early in our marriage. We were both military, both A-10 pilots, both kind of working our way up in promotions. And we got advice, very kind advice, was that one of us would need to leave the military for us to be successful, that we both couldn't continue moving on in our careers. And we kind of acknowledged that advice and realized that we didn't like it. And that we would keep going, we would keep doing what we were doing until it didn't work for us. And, you know, we both ended up making the rank of colonel. We both were commanders, and my husband served for 25 years and I served for 24 years. So nice advice, but terrible advice. I mean, and sometimes advice is just that, right? It's based on somebody else's beliefs and experiences and not really knowing your experience and your life. So advice is what you pay for it, take it or leave it, right?
So true. And I always find it interesting where people offer a either or circumstance as opposed to, well, but what's the end?
Yeah.
So
yeah. Turns out we can do this. We did have to make some sacrifices along the way, but for us it was worth it. And we did it with kids. So, you know, we kind of doubled down on that.
That's amazing. So when you see potential for a new partnership, what's the first thing you do to turn that potential into action?
To me, it's all about building relationships. It's building that connections. I think it has to start from an authentic place of actual human level connection. I think to me, that's the biggest thing. And I guess I've probably said the word connection multiple times in this discussion, but I truly believe in the power of human connection and connecting with people on a very real, human, authentic level.
I love it. Now, I often get told when I ask this final question that can I have more than one? So I'll say to you right now, what's one or a few things that you're deeply grateful for right now?
I am very grateful for more time with my family. And I think having served for 24 years, having had multiple deployments, I am in this next phase, this next chapter of my life. And I have control over my schedule. I can say no. I'm still working on that, but I have time with my family and I am truly grateful for, you know, my husband and I had kids a little bit later in life. And so now with an 11-year-old and a 16-year-old, I'm grateful that I am home at a very critical point in their life where they do need a little bit of, you know, feedback, parenting, you know, oversight. So I'll just give you the one. I'm very grateful for my time with my family.
That's amazing. And I feel you. We talked about this earlier. I feel you at that stage of life as well. Kim Campbell, it has been such an honor to speak with you today. Thank you for your generous spirit and all of the lessons you've shared with me and so many others. You spend a lot of your days outside of family, you know, doing your leadership work, speaking to organizations, engaging in all of this lesson and knowledge transfer. We are going to link to your website and to your amazing book, Flying in the Face of Fear. Where can people go to learn more about you and to connect with you if they'd like to bring you into their organization?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, my website is the kind of the one-stop shop, if you will. It's kim-kc-campbell. I know you said you'd link it. So it's got links there to my email, social media, and I really am happy for people to reach out on social media. If there's something we didn't cover, if there's something that you want to know more of, you know, please reach out. I'm on LinkedIn at kim-kc-campbell.com and Instagram, X, Twitter, previously Twitter, just reach out in any way that works for you because it really, one, I love the feedback. I love the connection. I think it's powerful to reach around the world and connect with people, To me, you know, the reason I'm doing this is I really am passionate about leadership development. I feel like so many people took a chance on me and shared stories with me and shared lessons with me throughout my career. And so now I want to be able to do the same. And that's my new why. That's my new purpose in life.
Incredible. Well, Kim, I am excited for our next conversation in whatever form that takes. So thank you so much, and we'll see you soon.
Absolutely. Thanks for making it easy and fun.
Thanks for listening to the end of this episode of Partnership Plus. If you like what you heard, you can share this episode via text message. And if you'd like to build your business partnership muscle, my free weekly newsletter called Wednesday Partnership will help you do just that. You'll find a link in the show notes. Finally, I'm big on encouragement and love to see people be in motion towards their ambitions. So if you know someone who might be struggling, reach out to them with a quick message of encouragement. It could change their life. Thanks again, and I'll see you in the next episode.